Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the committee to order. Today is the 17th of February, and it's about 3:07. And present are Representative Wohl, Representative Foster, Representative Tallarico, myself, Chair Seaton. Representative Vasquez is excused for the day. I'd like to remind everybody about their cell phones, if they would silence those. And as we're having discussions, to the address the questions through the chair. And today we're going to be hearing a presentation by the American Cancer Society, followed by Alaskan youth who are in the Capitol as part of the Youth Policy Summit. And so from the Alaska Cancer Society, we have Emily Neenum, as well as the American Cancer Society Action Network National Deputy President Molly Daniels. Would you like to come forward, and we'll let you introduce each one of yourselves for the record. And then what I would like to do is, since we have two female voices, when you answer, when you speak, just say your name so that the secretary knows, or anybody online that's listening knows who's talking. Appreciate that.
Sure. So. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Seaton and members of the committee.
Great. And before you start, I wanted to recognize that Representative Stutz has joined us as well.
Point of tardiness. Thank you.
Again, good afternoon, Chair Seaton, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Neenum. I am the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And I am very pleased to have a number of volunteers with me today, and also our national deputy president for our organization, Molly Daniels. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Molly Daniels, deputy president for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network out of Washington, D.C.
Thank you. And who's going to present first?
We're going to be going back and forth during this presentation. This is Emily, and so I'll let Molly kick it off there.
So this is Molly Daniels? Yes, sir.
And when you introduce yourself, you can just use your first name, would be fine, okay, instead of being quite so formal.
Okay, this is Molly, and I want to thank you for the time this afternoon. I'm delighted to be in here from Washington, D.C., where the weather is gorgeous here. D.C., it's actually shut down right now. The federal government is actually closed, so I'm not going back, ever. I've had a great trip to Juneau and have met some wonderful volunteers. I am trusting that many of you have met with them today, as they have been around the Capitol talking about issues of importance to cancer patients. So I just want to thank you for not only having Emily and I here, but giving those volunteers time. They all have extremely powerful stories to tell, and they're going to share them with you. If they haven't met with you yet, they will share them with you this afternoon. Let me just start very briefly. We're going to try to keep this very succinct, give you all time for questions, but let me just start very succinctly with cancer by the numbers. You all, I'm sure, have seen some of them, but I think this particular slide captures them pretty quickly. Half of all men, one-third of all women will have cancer. We'll hear those words. 1.66 million Americans will be diagnosed with cancer in 2015. Over 580,000 Americans will die, and that averages out to 1,600 a day. And the cost of that to Americans in 2015 will be over $201 billion. Now, there are about 15 million living Americans who have fought or are currently have the disease, and many of the stories you hear are on behalf of those people. It is the second leading cause of death nationwide, but it is the leading cause of death in Alaska. And in a few minutes, I'm going to have Emily get more into sort of the Alaska perspective, if you will. But 3,700 people will be diagnosed with cancer. About a fourth of those diagnosed will lose the fight. That comes to a little over 1,000 people. 23% of all Alaska deaths are from cancer. And it's the leading cause of death for Alaska Native males and females and Alaska non-Native statewide. So how do you change those facts? How do you change those tough numbers? With what we know today, half of all cancer deaths could be prevented through changes in tobacco use, diet and physical activity, and ensuring access to health care. Now, over the last, this picture is funny because you see these are cancer researchers smoking pipes. And they're actually smoking pipes here because they had been doing their research and switched out of cigarettes, thinking that pipe tobacco was much better or something. They actually, all three of these researchers, if I understand correctly, actually gave up tobacco completely. But we have been doing cancer research for 100 years, and and go back to that. You can see some of the milestones in our efforts against cancer. One thing I wanted to point out on the next slide is that in 2007, ACS gave its first research grant in Alaska to Dr. Melanie Cuevo in the Alaska Native Communities. And even as we've been spending 100 years looking at research and how to cure cancer and look at public education and educating people about prevention, in the last 15 years, we've taken a much more active role in public policy because so many of the decisions that are made about cancer are not just in a doctor's office, but they're in a legislator's office. So that's why we're especially happy to have time with you all today. And, of course, one of the most obvious ways to change the facts is to improve the statistics about cancer outcomes in tobacco. And not only people who smoke, but people who are exposed to secondhand smoke. And this slide, again, lays out some of the milestones after the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health. 1964, the report linked smoking and lung cancer. 1988, the Surgeon General found that nicotine was indeed addictive. And in 2006, the Surgeon General's report said there's no risk-free level of exposure to secondhand smoke. But what you all probably know is that in 2014, there was a report from the Surgeon General marking 50 years of progress in January, and the 32nd Surgeon General's report on smoking and health provides even more evidence of the serious damage smoking does to the human body. It also commemorates the anniversary of the first report, and it laid the foundation, which laid the foundation for today's programs to reduce the disease and death caused by smoking. What we found out new in the 2014 report is that, not surprisingly, cigarettes have become more dangerous. Chemicals have changed over the years, making smokers 2 to 3 times more likely to die from smoking-related illness than they were 50 years ago. And that's double the risk of death for men and 3 times the risk for women. And these numbers are pretty incredible, but let me add one more. The U.S. cost of secondhand smoke is over $10 billion annually for medical costs and lost productivity due to premature death. That's on, obviously, in addition to these very difficult statistics you see up here on the screen. So let me turn it over to Emily Meenon, who's the Alaska Government Relations Director, to talk about the numbers and milestones as they relate specifically to Alaska. And she's also going to bring you up to date on specific Alaska issues with respect to a couple of the other ways to change the facts, and that is the obesity problem as well as access to care.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on the previous, on this slide right here. Is there scientific evidence that supports these statements?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, thank you. That's an excellent question. Yes, the answer is yes. And a lot of these numbers here are documented in that U.S. Surgeon General's report from last year. You will see some variations in that number of how many people secondhand smoke kills. There's a few ways to slice the issue. Some reports look just at adults and different ways to measure it. But absolutely, it's a real deadly issue, and there's quite a bit of documentation in the U.S. Surgeon General's report from last year.
But
Representative,
follow up. Thank you. So they've actually definitely connected it to secondhand smoke. I just ask. I'm a little bit curious, and I don't necessarily doubt it, but I know that a lot of people get lung cancer that haven't been around smoking and have never smoked. So I'm curious as to how they can. It makes sense to me if you're a smoker to say those cigarettes are going to kill you, but when you're just around it, I'm curious as to how they can absolutely pinpoint that it was because you were breathing somebody else's smoke.
Right, through the chair, Representative Stutz. Again, excellent question, and I would be happy to go into more detail, and there's actually some medical professionals traveling with me today that could go into more detail as well. But I will say that the large majority of lung cancers are related to smoking or secondhand smoke exposure. One of the things to remember when you're looking at lung cancer, it takes a while to develop. secondhand smoke and cardiovascular disease, those things actually happen a lot faster than it takes to develop. Lung cancer is a longer process to develop. And when you look back at risk factors over time, all of us in this room remember a lot of times where there may have been people smoking right in this room. One of my first jobs in college was in the records room of a courthouse doing title searches. We were in the fireproof vault, and they allowed smoking inside the fireproof vault. So there is a long history of exposure to secondhand smoke. So we're still working on reducing that exposure for all workers.
Thank you.
Thank you. So to continue, this is Emily. With the Alaska milestones, Alaska has a lot to be proud of, and I'm always happy to show off our progress to our visitors from our national organization and others, and has been a real leader in tobacco prevention efforts. All these efforts, there are three pieces of tobacco prevention that really play together, and we really do need all three of them working together. Those public education pieces in the communities, local education around the dangers of tobacco use and secondhand smoke, and support for not only prevention but cessation. Alaska's tobacco quit line is an example of that, that comprehensive prevention program. That's one piece. The second piece is raising the price of the product. That particularly has an impact in keeping kids from ever starting to use tobacco. And then the third piece is protection from secondhand smoke. So those are the three pieces we're looking at. With the work that we've done in Alaska, we saw first the decline in youth smoking, and now we're seeing the decline in adult smoking. It's pretty stunning how far we've come, and I want to mention The cost savings are there, the lives saved are there. I was looking for the piece about youth smoking. We have gotten recognition from the CDC and a number of national organizations for our work in tobacco prevention in Alaska. We've seen successes in this state in reducing the health disparities around tobacco use and its effects that other places in the country haven't gotten to yet, and people are really looking to us. When we saw the youth smoking drop, youth smoking has dropped overall, but Alaska Native youth smoking has dropped even faster than the general population youth smoking. So we're reducing that disparity, which is really, really exciting to see. We've seen drops in adult smoking rates. In the last few years, Alaska Native adult smoking rates have dropped. They are not yet statistically significant, but we are anxiously awaiting that day when we can say that Alaska Native adult smoking has made a statistically significant drop. So we're just keeping up our efforts. And the fact remains, 14,000 Alaska youth alive today will die prematurely from tobacco use unless we continue our work to change that curve. There are new products on the market. We talked a little bit about this in the last year before this committee, and there's a tremendous amount of research being done in the area of electronic cigarettes right now. We don't know the long-term health effects of these products. There are over 400 different individual products on the market. They are not regulated, so there's no one person that can tell you exactly what's in any given product, which makes it very challenging then to determine what is in it. When you all have been discussing the issue of marijuana, what we've seen in Colorado is now legally being sold electronic cigarettes with marijuana in them that look like traditional tobacco electronic cigarette with the flavorings that are added. People often think like you all, I'm sure I'm learning a lot about marijuana these days. But people often think, well, you'll know by the smell, right? Well, actually, if you put enough flavorings in, you can also disguise the smell of a marijuana e-cigarette. So when we say we don't know what's in them, I'm telling you, we really, really don't know what's in them, what's in any given one. That research continues. The main thing that we're looking at right now is making sure that people are protected from secondhand exposure. Some people have said they've used them to quit smoking. They're not FDA approved, and there's no regulation of the product. Wouldn't necessarily be my choice, but I'm not going to tell somebody else if it worked for them. Great. There's more research to be done in that arena. Our position is take them outside and protect others from exposure.
And Emily, just a comment. I don't see it on the paper that Alaska made it illegal to sell or give nicotine, non-tobacco nicotine, to children. And so I think it's very important that we took the step to keep kids from becoming addicted to nicotine, in which they might future switch to using a tobacco product. So, and also just should be recognized that we have in the bill in front of our committee on marijuana, we have it in there a provision that you could not put nicotine or alcohol combined with THC products. Mm-hmm. So we're trying on this front to keep people from becoming addicted to nicotine, which would then possibly cause them to switch to tobacco products in the future. I didn't see it on here, and I wanted to draw the attention to the fact that a lot of people don't know that if you have an e-cigarette, it's illegal to sell or give that other than by a parent or by a physician for use as a tobacco cessation product to a minor.
Yes. Sorry to interrupt you, but I'm excited about what you're saying, Chair Seaton. Absolutely, it is Alaska was a leader in the nation in looking at that issue, recognizing the new products coming on the market and the dangers of starting nicotine addiction very young. Some of the new products we're seeing, not only with electronic cigarettes, but other smokeless tobacco products in all manner of flavors, from gummy bears to cotton candy to all the rest. And Alaska was a leader. Thank you, Chair Seaton and the body, for work in that arena. So, moving on, we talked about smoke-free workplaces a little bit. We have about half the population now covered by a smoke-free workplace law. Now, obesity, here's where it gets fun. So we've spent the last 50, 60 years talking about the link between tobacco and cancer, and people have kind of gotten that. We've had some success, and I say we as a society have had a lot of success in getting that message across to folks. When it comes to physical activity, nutrition, and obesity, that evidence base is newer, but just as stunning. One-third of all cancer deaths are related to tobacco. One-third of all cancer deaths are related to issues around diet, physical activity, and obesity. Now, there's some overlap between those because some people have more than one risk factor. But what we're seeing is a stunning link, and we have tools to do something about it, and that's where we come in. If we don't do something about it, getting to the slide, looking at the Medicaid numbers, the cost curve just goes up and up as obesity rates have gone up and up. But we have good news to report here in the state. The Alaska legislature has done some investment in obesity prevention. We are very excited about the work that's being done here in Alaska. Again, a bit of a leader in the nation, and we're seeing results. We're seeing in both Anchorage and Mat-Su school districts, it's pretty stunning because it didn't take very long to see those youth obesity rates actually starting to drop. How do we get there? It's a combination of things. You have before you this slide, the anatomy of success, and it goes through all the different pieces that were in place to get you to that statistically significant drop in childhood obesity rates. It's very exciting to see.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Wolf.
Thank you. About obesity in Alaska, do you know where we rank compared to other states nationally? Are we above the national average?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, that's an excellent question. I have looked at those. I don't want to misspeak. I don't have them in front of me, but I'd be happy to get that back with you.
Okay.
So finally, third piece, when we said half of all cancer deaths could be prevented with what we know today, the third piece is access to care. Again, looking at what we've done in Alaska and across the nation, access to cancer screenings is making a difference. Colorectal cancer and breast cancer death rates have dropped 35% since 1991. Due to early detection, and Alaska has benefited from insurance coverage for first for mammography and then for colorectal cancer screening. There's more work to do. We'll talk about that a little bit if there's time for more questions or further follow-up. There are a lot of pieces to this issue around access to care. You all know very well that we have extraordinary challenges in this state with the issue of access to care. As an organization, we are strongly supportive of expansion of Medicaid to just get more people coverage. Another issue that we've spent a lot of time working on nationally and a little bit of time working on here, we'll be doing more in the future, is access to appropriate pain and symptom management. So that people are able to, there's a myriad of policy implications when you start looking at pain management and wanting to make sure that cancer patients have access to care, improves actually survival rates just by having access to appropriate pain management. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Molly for the next steps.
Now, let me just close by, first of all, thanking you for your time today, thanking you for the time you're spending talking to the volunteers. As I mentioned earlier, one of the big efforts in the organization nationwide has been over the last 15 years to build up our advocacy capabilities, not only through hiring good staff, but really building up our volunteer program. You met some of those folks today, and I just wanted to assure you that you will continue to hear from them. Some of them are in the room today. They will be talking to you post-lobby day to talk about the issues that Emily was raising. They're going to be working in coalitions to make sure that we are getting the information in front of you about how strongly people feel about these issues around Alaska. They will be educating the public to get them more involved. They will be providing follow-up information as you need it. They will be responding, including with Emily, to other issues you identify, like vitamin D or colorectal screening coverage in Alaska or Affordable Care Act implementation issues. So we thank you for the time today. We look forward to working with you closely in the future on a lot of the issues we brought up today. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Wolf.
Thank you. One of your you mentioned creating more smoke-free workplaces, not work-free smoke places, but
we love that.
Smoke-free workplaces, and it's probably in relation to a bill that's going around. And I know certain municipalities have smoke-free health powers, I guess, where they can enact certain laws, and certain ones don't. And within Alaska, there's Anchorage, for example, is the smoke-free city. But the state isn't as a whole. Around the country, are many states smoke-free? Or are they more municipality by municipality? I'm sure there's a mix, but how many other states, for example, are smoke-free?
Through the chair, My understanding, and I think this is right, there are 26 states that are completely smoke-free in workplaces, in restaurants, and bars. There are a number of, there are very few states that don't have smoke-free communities, but there are a number of states where we're working on building more and more community smoke-free laws, hoping that that's a tipping point in those states for statewide laws.
Okay.
But I think 60% of the population is covered by smoke-free laws at this point, extensive smoke-free laws around the country.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf. Follow
up. Thank you. And what was the percentage within Alaska? You said it earlier, but it's probably largely due to Anchorage, which is where most people live. So go ahead.
Yes. Through the chair, this is Emily. Representative Wolf. About half the population of Alaska is currently covered by a strong smoke-free workplace law. And that started, actually, Bethel was the first community to pass a smoke-free law back in 1998. So we've got Bethel, Barrow, Dillingham, Unalaska, Juneau, Anchorage, Skagway, Haines, Klawak. I'm probably leaving a couple off.
Nome,
yes. How could I forget? Palmer, some of our more recent successes. And so nobody's surprised when the American Cancer Society, American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, says we believe that everyone should be protected from secondhand smoke. So there are some issues with limitations of borough health powers. There's also 70,000 Alaskans living in the unorganized borough, many without a local community like Nome, local city council, to take that action. So the state really is the place that can take that action. Other people will talk to you about borough powers. We're here to talk to you about protecting everyone from secondhand smoke.
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, the largest focus of this committee has been on prevention. More than just access or treatment after people get sick. Mm-hmm. And you know, a good portion of our emphasis has been looking at data from studies and especially on vitamin D. And we have an open clinical trial that's going on with Grassroots Health across the nation, and we had the data a few weeks ago of the 844 women that were elevating their levels of vitamin D, and those that got above 50, the half of them, because that was the median, above 50, 72% reduction in the rate for those that were below 50, and compared to the Alaska rate for women over 60, because this was all just women over 60, is an 82% reduction in the relative risk of breast cancer. Have you been getting any other information from clinical trials or studies that have shown similar results?
Thank you, Chair Seaton. This is Emily. Excellent question. And you and I have had this conversation before, and we've had this conversation in this committee before, and I had the distinct honor myself to speak with some of the leading researchers with our national organization, with the American Cancer Society out of Atlanta, about this particular issue. There are many promising studies being conducted trying to piece out, okay, so we know tobacco, we figured out some elements of physical activity, nutrition, obesity, we know just getting people to care so we can prevent, but what is that other piece? How do we prevent, how do we stop this disease process before it takes off? The American Cancer Society is proud to be the second largest funder of cancer research in this nation. The federal government is number one, in case you're wondering. And it's our job to make sure that they keep investing. The American Cancer Society is in the midst of conducting its third cancer prevention study. What this is a prospective study. We just finished enrollment, not me personally, I didn't have anything to do with it, but people in Atlanta just finished enrollment 300,000 individuals across the nation. There's blood samples on everyone. I spoke with the researcher who put in the questions about vitamin D on that survey. There's a tremendous amount of work being done. She also has been looking at ACS has published 30 papers looking at the vitamin D issue in the last 10 years. There's particularly promising information looking at the link between higher blood levels of vitamin D and reduction in colorectal cancer. That is of particular interest in Alaska because we have high rates of colorectal cancer. The Alaska Native population has the highest incidence of colorectal cancer of any population group in the nation. So we are watching those things, and I'm watching. There are folks who are actively investigating. One of the other things that I'll just mention that was brought up are the challenges with doing the randomized controlled trials because so many people are now taking vitamin D supplementation. Sometimes it can be hard to do your pure science, somebody without any vitamin D supplementation, just finding that. But when we start looking at our cancer prevention study 3 and 300,000 enrollees, there's a tremendous amount of promise on the horizon.
Thank you on that. And I would just like to share with you so you can share it with them, mm-hmm. The work by Professor Hollis in mm-hmm. Atlanta. Mm-hmm. They've just found in the last year, it was amazing when I was at a conference and saw the thermal micrographs of human cell colonies that were growing, and they infused, they put 25 hydroxy vitamin D, what circulates in your blood, infused that around the cells and there was no change. And as soon as they used vitamin D3 and put that around them, it immediately sparkled all over the cells because it was like a functional MRI where you're looking at the heat generated because it's being metabolized. And so that was very interesting, especially since vitamin D3 only has a 24-hour half-life in the body, so it's used up very rapidly. So I hope you'll share with them when you're talking about the design of their studies, and we can show you some more of that information. But if you are doing a monthly dose, you are not testing whether vitamin D has an effect. You're testing whether a dosing regime of taking something once a month will have an effect, because it will raise the blood level, because that's held in the body for over 3 weeks. But it's not the active portion that's going to be utilized by the soft tissues. And we're talking about breast cancer, so that's soft tissue. So I'd love to share that brand new information with you, because you can just pretty well go back and look at the studies and say, well, this study didn't show anything, and you'll find a monthly or a quarterly dose. Mm-hmm. And if you were trying to adjust somebody's cholesterol, there are not many doctors that would give them all of their cholesterol medicine one day a month. I mean, you know, that's not really the way the body works very well. So I really appreciate what the American Cancer Association and the network is doing, and we all want to improve the health across Alaska as well as the rest of the nation. So Representative Wool.
Sorry, just one more question. You mentioned that cancer was the second leading cause of death in the U.S., but the first leading cause in Alaska. And you cited the fact that it's within the Native community, it was the highest rate of, I can't remember.
Through the chair, Alaska Natives have the highest incidence of colorectal cancer of any population group in the nation.
Okay.
It doesn't show up when you search it on the Centers for Disease Control website, because Alaska Natives and American Indians are lumped together as a population group.
Okay.
And there are some American Indians in the nation that have lower than average incidence of colorectal cancer. So you really have to separate out the Alaska Natives on their own. It's pretty stunning. African Americans have 1.5 times the risk for colorectal cancer of the U.S. white population. For Alaska Natives, it's 2 times the incidence and risk for colorectal cancer.
I guess my question is,
Representative,
sorry, thank you for the follow-up, but my question would be, and I don't know if you know the answer, is the causation, and obviously smoking is a risk factor, diet and obesity are risk factors, genetics might be a risk factor, obviously all these things are risk factors. So and maybe you can't identify one causational thing, but I didn't know if the fact that it's the leading cause here in Alaska and not in the rest of the country, if there's other things, other risk factors, environmental factors, obesity, stuff like that, if you've come to any conclusions on that.
Through the chair, briefly, our tobacco use rates have certainly contributed to being above the national average. We're starting to bend that curve, so it'd be interesting to see where we go over time. And then for things like, there's the Alaska Native Epidemiology Center at ANTHC has been looking at this, how do we explain the higher incidence of colorectal cancer. Our focus is on what we know now. We know that you can prevent colorectal cancer through screening colonoscopy by removing polyps before they become cancerous. So getting more access to colonoscopies throughout the state is a huge issue for us.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much,
thank you for coming
and presenting to us today. We look forward to talking with you in the future.
Thank you for your time.
And now we have the Youth Policy Summit. Do we have people representing the Youth Policy Summit? And if you'd go ahead and come forward, and we'll get some other chair. If you wouldn't mind pulling the chairs from around there, if they'll fit easily. If they won't. You can slide some other chairs up behind there if you can and get everybody crowded around, but what we want to make sure is if you're speaking, you get one of the microphones and
hold it pretty close.
Hold it six inches away or so.
All right, everybody good? All right.
Well, good afternoon. We're sure happy to have you here today. The committee is always interested in hearing from youth from around the state. So would you go ahead and introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your program, what you're doing?
All right, thank you. My name is Rusty Vest, and I'm a adult supporter for the Alaska Youth Policy Summit. I currently work for Alaska Youth and Family Network in Anchorage, Alaska. And I would like to go around starting over here and have the youth introduce themselves.
Yeah, can you slide over and speak in the microphone?
Yeah, hold it pretty close.
My name is Robin Ugapuk. I'm 20 years old. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska.
I'm Samuel Johnson from Cordova.
My name is Lee Breinig. I'm 26 years old, and I'm from Anchorage, Alaska.
I'm Benjamin Dalhuzon. I'm 17 years old, and I'm from Anchorage, Alaska.
Hello, my name is Heather Kelly. I'm 22 years old, and I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska.
Well, great. Sounds like a real diversity across the state. What's your program here in Juneau, and what are you doing?
Well, we brought youth down from all across the state to come and share their stories with their legislators and to be able to talk about some of the things that the things that they've experienced in their lives and how it's impacted them and how that they would like to see the future of other youth being impacted by being able to change some of the things that they hadn't happened to them. They get to tell their stories to everyone. And I think Robin was going to go first here. Or we can start without.
And that's fine. Just to let you know, we only have about 10 minutes before we all have to go to another meeting, but yeah, we're happy to hear from you and see what we can do to help in the future.
Okay, I would just like to thank you for this opportunity to meet with you, Mr. Chair. And my name is Heather Kelly. I am 22 years old, born and raised from Fairbanks, Alaska. I struggled with alcohol and substance abuse for 8 years. And this year, at the age of 22, is when I wanted to change my life and to seek recovery and to get into a treatment. And in Fairbanks, there was no help for me. They told me to go to Anchorage. Their residential treatment was full. There was nothing. Detox centers were full. So I went down to Anchorage. And in Anchorage, also, they had wait lists 3 months out, detox centers, only one detox center in the whole state, which is the Ernie Turner Center, which was all full. And it was a very hard time trying to seek help. And thankfully, I met with the Alaska Native Justice Center Youth Coordinator, and that's where I was finally getting the help I was looking for. And getting that help, it was really great to have the opportunity. And after waiting 40 days of waiting to get into a residential treatment center, I was stable enough to undergo intensive outpatient treatment, which I would like to ask Mr. Chair that hopefully in the future they could better the residential treatment center to not be so overcrowded and people that are wanting to seek recovery not have to wait months out, and to have a personal help with the youth navigator and young adults to help them, like at the Alaska Native Justice Center.
Well, thank you. And the Alaska Native Justice Center is in Anchorage, and that's where you were able to... Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Dozon. I'm 17-year-old junior at East Anchorage High School, and from the age of 5 to 10, I was in foster care. And in foster care, I would repeatedly lash out. I had bad anger issues because growing up I was exposed to domestic violence in my household, exposed to drugs and alcohol with my parents being heavy addicted addicts, and that would cause me to lash out. So eventually around 8 years old, I went to counseling, and that helped me to kind of break out of my shell, kind of let my emotions go, kind of help to better myself and to not blame people for what I had been through, and to not take my anger out on others. And at the age of 10, I was adopted, and that also gave me a better opportunity to better myself and to show who I really am as a person, and so that that had a big impact on my life, and it changed my life. And also, if there's anything that I would ask you for is to just support, I believe it's Hospital 27 that talks about foster care in Alaska, and to also try to support something that gets the funding back for certain places for homeless youth, such as the Covenant House, and other programs such as the Boys and Girls Club and the YMCA, which were so influential to help me in my growth. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
My name is Lee Breinig. Good to speak with you today, Mr. Chair. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm currently a college student at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I'm majoring in Health and Human Services. This is my first time down with the Alaska Youth Policy Summit. I went to high school here in Juneau for 3 years, and during that time I became addicted to opioid narcotics. After graduating, I still was struggling with my addiction. It became an issue to the point where I was dealing and committing crimes to support my addiction. It wasn't until 2010 that my actions and choices caught up with me, and I got a felony charge for possession of a handgun, and it was a stolen firearm. So I went to treatment in Anchorage, Alaska at Providence Breakthrough, and a week after graduating treatment, February 28th, 2011, I was handed down my sentence. I did 4 months in jail, and when I got out, I decided I wanted to pursue a career as a substance abuse and counselor, but the issues have been the barrier crimes matrix that's currently in place with the Division of Health and Social Services. I believe it needs to be reexamined. I understand it's in place to protect vulnerable populations from criminals abusing people, for instance, elders or youth or people with mental or physical disabilities. But at a certain point, you get, when working with addicts and alcoholics who have sort of walked the walk and are also in recovery themselves, I feel you can get, and research has shown, better buy-in from your clients if they're working with a substance abuse counselor that we call it field experience. So I've been limited primarily to volunteer work through the Alaska Mental Health Consumer Web, and right now I'm an intern at the Alaska Native Justice Center. I'm about 98% complete with a degree in applied science and health and human services, but the barrier crimes is preventing me from getting a job. I'm 26 years old. I'm living with my mom and get on with my life. So if that can maybe be reexamined, that would be excellent. Thank you for your time, Mr. Church.
Thank you.
I'm Samuel Johnson from Cordova. My sister is multiple disabilities. My dad is a slight workaholic, and my mother spends a lot of time with my sister, but she also does some work. So I had to assume a place of responsibility in my household. This caused me to, you know, mature relatively quickly. I was able to guide peers thanks to that. My peers would come to me with lots of problems. Some of it was just normal teen angst, but I've also seen people who self-harm. They have eating disorders. They are addicted to drugs and alcohol. They have OCD or bipolar disorder. Some of them are even considering suicide, actually quite a few. And I'm just a peer to them, so I can only offer so much, just a listening ear. What they really need is counselors, so I suggest that they get counselors quite often. And a lot of my friends have done this, but some of them talk to their parents and ask to see a counselor, only to have their parents tell them that they can't. So I've been kind of proposing the idea of things like teen clinics, so teens can see counselors even when their parents either refuse to pay or refuse to let their kids see one, because youth is a very volatile time for, you know, adolescents, and it's very important what happens in your youth. It affects your entire life. The better your childhood, the more likely you are to have a successful adult life. And there's a lot of kind of stigmas about kids. It's very hard for propositions and stuff involving kids to go through unless it's making rules stricter. So just a little window from 16 to 18, which would be the time between when youth in Alaska can be officially emancipated and the time that they are no longer legally under the parent supervision. Just that window could change a lot of lives with just clinics or a counselor who goes to rural communities. So that's what I'm asking for.
For the suggestions here, they're all very good.
Mr. Chair, I'm Robin Ugapuk. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, 20 years old. I'm a former foster youth, and I was in foster care for 15 years and had 48 placements. and 52 social workers. I'm here today just to talk and show my experience. Foster care, I moved 18 different schools, so I had to grow up fast, and I was a loner, so I stayed to myself, and that had harmful effects to my immune system, and so I would be depressed and stay to myself, and like I said, I had 52 social workers, and I'm here to say that better background checks and to get better social workers and help the social worker workload, because the normal workload is 30 caseloads and my last social worker had 150 caseloads, so it's like triple amount, and that's harmful to this workload, to the social workers and to the youth, because they don't get their needs met. And so just yeah, that's it.
Well, thank you very much. Are there questions for any of the youth policy? Some. Thank you very much for coming down and giving us these suggestions and ideas, and we'll keep them in mind as we go along, and there may be an opportunity for incorporating them into some of the legislation as we go forward. So thank you again for coming down and meeting with the committee, and hope you have a great policy summit. And so with that, the committee is going to be adjourned at 3:57.